No more blazers and ties. No more morning chapel. No more bus trips through Central Park. No more days trapped in a building without girls. All of which were decided improvements. But the biggest difference between the third and fourth grades was not so much the leap to another school as the end of Ferguson's duel with God. God had been defeated, exposed as a powerless non-entity who could no longer punish or inspire fear. And with the celestial overman now cut out of the picture, Ferguson could give up playing the old game of screw-up, or, as he sometimes called it in later years, ontological chicken. He had succeeded so well at failure that he had grown tired of his gift for subterfuge and self-immolation. No one at Hilliard had ever suspected what he'd been up to. He had fooled them all, not only his teachers and fellow students, but his mother and Aunt Mildred as well. Not one of them had ever figured out that he had done it on purpose, that his wildly erratic performance in the third grade had been nothing but an act, a cannily devised effort to prove that nothing he did could ever matter if no divine force were watching over him. He had won the argument with himself by getting thrown out of Hilliard. Not expelled exactly, since they allowed him to stay until the end of the year, but they had seen enough of Ferguson to want no more of him after that. The headmaster told his mother that Archie was the most daunting enigma he had ever come across in all his years at the school. He was both the best student and the worst student in the class, he said, at times brilliant and at other times utterly moronic, and they no longer knew what to do with him. Were they looking at a latent schizophrenic, he asked, or was Archie just another lost boy who would eventually find himself? Since Ferguson's mother knew her son was neither a moron nor a future mental case, she thanked the headmaster for his time and set about looking for another school. He received his first report card from the Riverside Academy on a Friday in mid-November. After an entire year of pours and fails from Hilliard, Ferguson's mother was expecting better results from the new school, but nothing close to the 7 excellents and 2 very goods Ferguson brought home that day. Stunned by the magnitude of the reversal, she walked into the living room at 5:30, just as the Laurel and Hardy show was ending, and sat down beside her son on the floor. "Good work, Archie," she said, holding up the packet of grades in her right hand as she tapped it with her left. "I'm very proud of you." "Thanks, Ma," Ferguson replied. "You must be enjoying your new school." "It's pretty good, all things considered." "What does that mean?" "School is school, which means it's not something anyone enjoys that much. You go because you have to go." "But some schools are better than others, aren't they?" "I suppose. For instance, Riverside is better than Hilliard." "Hilliard wasn't bad, for school, that is." "But you prefer not having to travel so far every day, don't you? And not having to wear a uniform, and having girls and boys together instead of just boys. It makes life a little better, doesn't it?" "Much better. But the school itself isn't that different. Reading, writing, arithmetic, social studies, gym, art, music, and science. I do the same things at Riverside that I did at Hilliard." "What about the teachers?" "About the same. I thought they were less strict at Riverside." "Not really. Miss Dunn, the music teacher, yells at us sometimes. But Mr. Bowles, the music teacher at Hilliard, never raised his voice. He's the best teacher I've had anywhere. And the nicest." "But you have more friends at Riverside. Tommy Snyder, Peter Baskin, Mike Goodman, Alan Lewis. All such fine boys. And that cutie pie, Isabel Kraft. And her cousin, Alice Abrams. Beautiful children. Real winners. In 2 months, you've made as many friends as you ever had in New Jersey. They're fun to be with. Some of the other kids, not so much. Billy Nathanson is about the meanest toad I've ever met. Much worse than anyone at Hilliard." "But you didn't have any friends at Hilliard, Archie. Sweet Doug Hayes, I guess, but no one else I can think of." "It was my fault. I didn't want any friends there." "Oh, and why is that?" "It's hard to explain. I just didn't want any." "No friends and bad grades at one school. Lots of friends and good grades at another school. There has to be a reason for that. Do you have any idea what it is?"
"Yes."
"And?"
"I can't tell you."
"Don't be ridiculous, Archie. You'd be mad at me if I tell."
"Why on earth would I be mad at you? Hilliard's in the past now. It makes no difference anymore.
Maybe not, but you'll still be mad at me.
And what if I promise not to be mad?
It won't do any good.
Ferguson was looking down at the floor by then, pretending to examine a loose thread in the carpet as a way to avoid his mother's eyes. For he knew he would be lost if he dared to look into them now. Her eyes had always been too strong for him. They were charged with a power that could decipher his thoughts and extract confessions from him and overwhelm his puny will, even as he fought to resist her. And now, horribly and inevitably, she was reaching out and touching his jaw with the tips of her fingers, gently prodding him to lift his face and look into her eyes again. And the moment he felt her hand make contact with his skin, he knew that all hope was gone. Tears were gathering in his eyes, the first tears that had been there in months, and how humiliating it was to feel the invisible faucet turn on again without warning. No better than stupid, weepy Stan, he said to himself. A 9-year-old infant with faulty plumbing in his brain. And by the time he found the courage to fix his eyes on his mother's eyes, two waterfalls were trickling down his cheeks, and his mouth was moving. Words were tumbling out of them. The story of Hilliard was being told, the battle with God, and the reason for the bad grades, the silenced voice and the murder of his father, breaking the rules in order to be punished, and then hating God for not punishing him, hating God for not being God. And Ferguson had no idea if his mother understood what he was telling her. Her eyes looked pained and confused and almost tearful. And after he had been talking for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, she leaned over, put her arms around him, and told him to stop. "Enough, Archie," she said. "Let it go." And then the two of them were crying together. A marathon sob fest that lasted for close to 10 minutes, which was the last time either one of them broke down in the presence of the other. Almost 2 years to the day since Stanley Ferguson's body had been put in the ground. And once the crying slowly came to an end, they washed their faces, put on their overcoats, and went out to the movies, where they gorged themselves on hot dogs in the balcony instead of eating dinner, and then shared a large box of popcorn, which they washed down with fizzless, watery cokes. The title of the movie they saw that evening was The Man Who Knew Too Much. Years passed. Ferguson was 10, 11, and 12. He was 13 and 14. And among the family events that occurred during those 5 years, the most important was no doubt his mother's marriage to a man named Gilbert Schneiderman, which happened when Ferguson was 12 and a half. A year before that, the Adler clan had lived through its first divorce, the inexplicable breakup between Aunt Mildred and Uncle Paul, a couple who had always seemed so right for each other, two chattering bookworms who had been married for 9 years with no apparent conflicts or betrayals. And then it was all over. Aunt Mildred was moving to California to join the English department at Stanford, and Uncle Paul was no longer Ferguson's Uncle Paul. Then his grandfather disappeared, a heart attack in 1960. And not long after that, his grandmother was gone as well, a stroke in 1961. And within a month of that second funeral, Great Aunt Pearl was diagnosed with terminal cancer. The Adlers were diminishing. They had begun to look like one of those families in which no one got to be very old. Schneiderman was the firstborn son of his mother's former boss, the man with the German accent who had taught her photography during the early days of the war. And since Ferguson understood that his mother was bound to remarry at some point, he was not opposed to her choice, which struck him as the best choice among the several that had been available to her. Schneiderman was 45, 8 years older than Ferguson's mother, and the two of them had first crossed paths on the morning she started working at his father's studio in November 1941. Which somehow comforted Ferguson, knowing that his mother had met his stepfather even before she met his father, 1941 as opposed to 1943, a date that had previously marked the beginning of the world for him. But now the world had become even older than that, and it was reassuring to know there was already an accumulated past between them, and therefore She wasn't rushing into the marriage blindly, which had always been Ferguson's greatest fear. Watching his mother get swept off her feet by some smooth-talking clown, and then waking up in the morning to discover she had committed the mistake of her life. No, Schneiderman seemed to be a solid sort, someone you could trust. Married to a woman for 17 years, father of 2 kids, and then a call from a state trooper summoning him to a Dutchess County morgue to identify a woman's body, the body of his wife, who had been killed in a car accident. Followed by 4 years alone, which was almost as long as Ferguson's mother had been alone since his father's death. His grandparents were still alive in September 1959, and the wedding was held in their apartment on West 58th Street, where the 5'2" Ferguson served as best man. Among the guests were his new stepsisters, 21-year-old Margaret and 19-year-old Ella, both college students, daughtering Emanuel Schneiderman, the foul-mouthed goat whom Ferguson had already met 3 or 4 times and would never consider a grandfather, not even after his own grandfather died, Gil's brother Daniel, his sister-in-law Liz, his 16-year-old nephew Jim, and 12-year-old niece Amy, all arms and legs, that girl, with braces on her teeth and a row of zits on her forehead, and Paul Sandler, Ferguson's ex-uncle, who remained his mother's champion in spite of the divorce from Mildred, the editor of her first 2 books, The Full-Length Jewish Wedding and the recently published Tufts, 90 black-and-white portraits of Puerto Rican street gang members and their girlfriends. But Aunt Mildred wasn't there. She had written that she was too busy with her courses at Stanford to make the trip. And as Ferguson looked at his ex-uncle Paul looking at his mother, he wondered if he hadn't been a contender for his mother's hand and had lost out to Gil Schneiderman, which could have meant that his breakup with Aunt Mildred had something to do with his belated understanding that he had fallen for the wrong sister. Impossible to know, but perhaps that explained why Mildred was in California that afternoon and not in New York, which also might have accounted for why she seemed to have broken off contact with Ferguson's mother, for no one said a word about her absence at the wedding party, at least not within earshot of Ferguson. And because he couldn't bring himself to ask his ex-uncle Paul or his grandparents why no one had mentioned it, the questions forming in his head that afternoon remained unanswered. Yet one more story that would never be told, he said to himself. And then he took the ring out of his pocket and handed it to the burly man with the high forehead and large ears who was about to become his stepfather. His mother called it a new beginning. And in the beginning of that beginning, there were many things to adjust to, a multitude of big things and small things that were suddenly and forever different now, starting with the big fact of living in a household made up of 3 people instead of 2, and the novelty of having that third person spend every night in his mother's bed, a 5'10" man with hair on his chest who walked around in the morning wearing old-fashioned boxer shorts and peed loudly into the toilet and hugged and kissed his mother every time she looked at him. A new breed of masculinity for Ferguson to contend with, broad-shouldered but unathletic, elegant in an old-fashioned, distracted sort of way. With his heavy tweed suits and vests, his sturdy shoes and longer-than-average hair, a bit awkward socially, not given to jokes or breezy chatter, tea in the morning instead of coffee, schnapps, cognac, and a nightly cigar, a steady, stolid, Germanic approach to the business of living, with occasional lapses into grumpiness and fits of distemper, a genetic gift from his father, no doubt, but mostly kind, often exceedingly kind, a stepfather who never showed the slightest ambition to become a substitute father and was happy to be addressed as Gil rather than Dad. For the first 6 months, the 3 of them lived together in the apartment on Central Park West, but then they moved to a larger place on Riverside Drive between 88th and 89th Streets, with a 4th bedroom that was turned into a study for Gil, a change that Ferguson welcomed because he now lived closer to his school and could sleep a little later in the morning. And although he missed the old apartment's 3rd-floor view of Central Park, he now had a 7th-floor view of the Hudson River, which turned out to be more stimulating because of the constant procession of boats and ships that moved back and forth across the water. And beyond the water, there was the land on the other side, the New Jersey side. And whenever Ferguson looked at it, he would think about his old life there and try to remember himself as a small boy. But that time was becoming so distant now, it was almost gone. Schneiderman was the chief music critic at the New York Herald Tribune, a demanding position that forced him to be out most evenings attending concerts, recitals, and operas. And then the deadline rushed to type up the review and deliver it to the arts editor that same evening, which seemed an almost impossible task to Ferguson. A mere 2 or 2.5 hours to marshal his thoughts about the performance he had just seen and heard and write something coherent about it. But Schneiderman was an old hand at working under pressure. On most nights, he finished his articles without once lifting his hands off the keyboard. And when Ferguson asked him how he could crank out the words so quickly, he answered his stepson by saying, "I'm really quite a lazy fellow, Archie, and if I didn't have deadlines bearing down on me, I'd never get anything done." And Ferguson was impressed that his stepfather could make fun of himself in that way, since it was clear to him that the man was anything but lazy. Schneiderman had stories to tell, unlike Ferguson's father, who had rarely told stories except for far-fetched ones about prospecting for gold in the Andes or shooting elephants in Africa. But these were true stories. And as the adjustment period gradually turned into something that resembled everyday life, Ferguson began to feel comfortable enough to press his mother's husband to talk to him about the past. For Ferguson's mind was no longer strictly a child's mind, and he enjoyed hearing what it had been like to grow up in Berlin, to be listening to someone who had spent the first 7 years of his life in that far-off city, which in Ferguson's imagination was first and foremost the capital of Hitler's hell, the most evil city on the face of the earth. But not then, Schneiderman informed him, not for someone who left there in 1921. And even if his life started just after the beginning of the First World War, what people had once called the Great War, he remembered nothing about it. The entire cataclysm was a blank to him. And the first event in his life that he could recall with any certainty was sitting at the kitchen table in his family's apartment in Charlottenburg with a piece of bread in front of him and covering the bread with spoonfuls of black currant jam as he watched his baby brother Daniel in his high chair, who was all of 6 or 8 months old at the time, which meant the war was about to end or was already over. And the reason why that scene remained so vivid to him was perhaps because Daniel was spewing forth a mass of clotted milk all over his bib without noticing it, smiling through the onslaught as he banged his hands against the table. And Schneiderman had marveled at the fact that someone could be so brainless and incompetent as to throw up on himself without being aware of what he was doing. No Hitler, then. But a momentous time for all that. The seeds of future disaster already being planted at Versailles. Armed struggle in Berlin as the Spartacist rebellion surged up briefly and was crushed. Followed by the arrests of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, whose murdered bodies were later found in the Landwehr Canal. Not to mention the outbreak of the Russian Civil War. The Reds against the Whites. The Bolsheviks against the world. And because Russia was so close to Germany, the sudden influx of refugees and émigrés who streamed into Berlin. Unstable, tottering Berlin, heart of the ragged Weimar Republic, in which a loaf of bread would eventually cost 20 million marks. It was essential that Schneiderman give the boy this rudimentary history lesson, so he would understand why the family had left for America, why Schneiderman's father had concluded that Germany was a dead-end place, and had gotten them out of there as quickly as possible, which proved to be just in time, since America put a stop to immigration in 1924 and barred the gates thereafter. But it was 1921 now, late summer, with Schneiderman about to turn 7 and his brother a month past 3, and off they sailed with their parents and a trunk full of German books, leaving from Hamburg on a ship called the SS Passage to India, bound for the mountainous territory of Washington Heights, or so Schneiderman had assumed. But his English was less than good at that point, almost non-existent, in fact. And what did a 7-year-old boy know about anything except what his parents had told him. The language was the toughest obstacle, his stepfather said. The difficulty of speaking English without a German accent, which made him stick out as a foreigner and led to taunts and frequent punches from the boys in his school. For he wasn't just any foreigner, but a German, the lowest, most despised form of humanity in those years after the war, a good-for-nothing Kraut, or Hun, or Bosch, or Heine, take your pick. And even as his understanding of English grew to a point of deepest familiarity, even as his vocabulary expanded and he conquered the nuances of English syntax and grammar, he still took his lumps because of that unseemly accent. "Wie go schwimming in die Sommer, ja, Archie?" Schneiderman said, by way of demonstration. And because Schneiderman rarely tried to be funny, Ferguson appreciated this little stab at humor, which in fact was quite funny, and he laughed, and an instant later they were both laughing. "The thing of it is," Schneiderman said, "knowing German probably saved my life." When Ferguson asked him to explain, his stepfather started talking about the war, about enlisting in the army just after Pearl Harbor, because he wanted to go back to Europe and kill Nazis. But because he was a little older than most of the boys, and because he'd gone to college and was fluent in both German and French, he was kept out of combat and thrown into an intelligence unit instead. Ergo, no duty on the front lines. And because of that, no bullets or bombs to put him in an early grave. Ferguson was, of course, eager to know what he had done in the intelligence unit. But like most men who had come home from the war, Schneiderman didn't want to talk about it. He simply said, "Interrogating German prisoners, interviewing Nazi officials, putting my German to good use." When Ferguson asked him to elaborate, Schneiderman smiled, patted his stepson on the shoulder, and said, "Some other time, Archie." If there was any drawback to the new arrangement, it was that Schneiderman had no interest in sports. Not in baseball or football, not in basketball or tennis, not in golf or bowling or badminton. Not just that he didn't play any of those games himself, but that he never even glanced at the sports pages, which meant that he paid no attention to the ups and downs of the local professional teams, not to speak of the college teams and high school teams, and ignored the exploits of every sprinter, shot putter, high jumper, broad jumper, long distance runner, golfer, skier, bowler, and tennis player in the world. One of the reasons why Ferguson had not been opposed to the idea of his mother getting married again was that he had assumed her second husband would necessarily be a sportsman, since she herself was so fond of swimming and tennis and ping-pong and even bowling, and he had been looking forward to having a grown man in the house with whom he could share some sporting activities, whether throwing around a baseball or a football or shooting baskets or playing tennis, didn't matter which one. And if this hypothetical stepfather turned out not to be an athletic sort of person, there was an excellent chance that he would be a fan of at least one sport, since most men were, as his grandfather had been, for example, whose sport had been baseball. And when the two of them hadn't been talking about Laurel and Hardy and asking themselves if the shorts weren't better than the features or vice versa, most of their conversations had been about analyzing the relative merits of Mantle, Snyder, and Mays, dissecting Alvin Dark's talent for smacking the ball to right center when the hit and run was on, debating who had the stronger arm, Ferrillo or Clemente, or if there was any truth to the story that Yogi Berra kept a razor blade in his right shin guard in order to nick up the ball before he threw it back to Whitey Ford. Every year from the age of 6 to 10, Ferguson had gone to at least 3 games with his grandfather, their annual tour of the New York City ballparks, the Polo Grounds in Manhattan, Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, and Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, where they saw their one World Series game together in 1955. But 3 was the minimum. And after Ferguson's father died, and the Dodgers and Giants left town, the total per season was usually 6 or 7 trips to Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built. And how Ferguson had savored those outings in the blistering, sunlit afternoons of July and August, eyes fixed on the field with its immaculate green grass and smooth brown soil, a formal garden tucked inside the great stone city, pastoral pleasures amid the raucous shouts and whistles from the crowd, 30,000 voices booing in unison. What a sound that was. And through it all, Grandfather would patiently keep score with his stubby pencil, predicting whether the batter would wind up on base or not, according to what he called the law of averages, meaning that a slumping batter was bound to get a hit because he was due. And no matter how many times he got it wrong, his grandfather never abandoned faith in his law, his flawed law of guesswork nonsense. All those games with his bizarre, incomprehensible papa, who on the warmest days would protect himself from the sun by spreading a white handkerchief over his bald head because it was too hot for hats. And now that he was gone, Ferguson understood that no one could ever take his place, least of all Schneiderman, who was probably the one New Yorker in any of the five boroughs whose heart hadn't been broken when the Dodgers and Giants decamped to California after the 1957 season. It was a drawback then, perhaps even a disappointment, to have fallen in with a man who had no feeling for the dramas and delights of physical competition. But in all fairness to Schneiderman, the opposite was no doubt also true. For Ferguson's inability to play a musical instrument must have come as a disappointment to his stepfather, who was skilled at both the piano and the violin. Not at the highest professional level, perhaps, but to Ferguson's untrained ear, his renditions of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert were flat-out marvels of beauty and precision, as good as anything to be heard on the hundreds of LP records Schneiderman had brought with him to Central Park West. It wasn't that Ferguson hadn't tried, but his struggle to master the rudiments of keyboard proficiency had ended in failure, at least according to his teacher, old frizzy-haired Miss Muggeridge, who probably freelanced as a witch when she wasn't breaking the spirits of young children forced to study the piano. After 9 months of lessons, when he was in the first grade, his mother was told he was a heavy-handed clod of a boy, which led her to conclude that she had started him too early. Forget about Mozart composing symphonies when he was 6 and 7. He didn't count. And when she suggested to her failed pianist that he take a year off before making a fresh start with another teacher, Ferguson was relieved that he would never have to see Miss Muggeridge again. The year off, of course, was the year of the Newark fire. And once they moved to New York and got past the curious interregnum, the little one was at Hilliard, the big one was in disarray, and the piano was forgotten. So Schneiderman had disappointed Ferguson, and Ferguson had disappointed Schneiderman. But since neither one of them ever spoke about it to the other, each one remained unaware of the other's disappointment. Eventually, when Ferguson became a starting forward on his freshman basketball team, Schneiderman began to show some interest in sports, at least to the extent of going to several games with Ferguson's mother, where he cheered on his stepson from the stands. But Ferguson never learned how to play a musical instrument. Still in all, it can safely be said that Ferguson profited more from his stepfather's involvement with music than Schneiderman did from his stepson's talent for putting balls in hoops and boxing out opponents for rebounds. At 12 and a half, Ferguson knew nothing about any kind of music except rock and roll, which he and his friends unanimously adored. His head was filled with the lyrics and melodies of Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Del Shannon, Fats Domino, and dozens of other pop singers. But when it came to classical music, he was a virgin, not to mention jazz, blues, and the nascent folk revival, about which he was utterly ignorant as well, barring some comic ballads by the Kingston Trio, who were having their moment then. Knowing Schneiderman changed all that. For a boy who had been to only 2 concerts in his life, a performance of Handel's Messiah at Carnegie Hall with Aunt Mildred and Uncle Paul, a matinee of Peter and the Wolf, which he saw with his lower school classmates during his first month at Hilliard, a boy who owned not a single record of classical music, whose mother owned not a single record of any kind, and listened only to ancient standards and big band stuff on the radio, for such a boy, who lacked even the smallest glimmer of knowledge about string quartets or symphonies or cantatas, just listening to his stepfather play the piano or the violin was a revelation. And beyond that, there was the further revelation of listening to his stepfather's record collection and discovering that music could actually reconfigure the atoms in a person's brain. And beyond what happened in the apartments on Central Park West and Riverside Drive, there were the excursions with his mother and Schneiderman to Carnegie Hall and Town Hall and the Metropolitan Opera House that began just weeks after the three of them settled in together. Schneiderman wasn't on a pedagogical mission. There was no plan to give the boy or his mother a formal education in music. He merely wanted to expose them to works he thought they would respond to, which meant not starting off with Mahler or Schoenberg or Webern, but with booming, joyful works such as the 1812 Overture, Ferguson gasped when he heard the canon for the first time, or histrionic pieces such as the Symphonie Fantastique, or the vibrant program music of Pictures at an Exhibition. But bit by bit, he lured them in. And before long, they were accompanying him to Mozart operas and Bach cello recitals. And for the 12 and 13-year-old Ferguson, who continued to adore the rock and roll he had always adored, those nights out in the concert halls were nothing less than a revelation about the workings of his own heart. For music was the heart, he realized, the fullest expression of the human heart. And now that he had heard what he had heard, he was beginning to hear better. And the better he heard, the more deeply he felt, sometimes so deeply that his body shook. The Adlers were shrinking. One after the other, they were dying their two early deaths and disappearing from the world. And with Aunt Mildred's removal to California, and ex-Uncle Paul's expulsion from the family, combined with the relocation to southern Florida by Cousin Betty and her husband Seymour, along with Ferguson's two second cousins, Eric and Judy, and the fact that Betty's sister Charlotte was still not talking to her cousin Rose because of the Wedding Pictures War of 1955 and 1956, Ferguson and his mother were the only Adlers left in New York, the only ones still above ground who hadn't absconded or smashed their links to the Klan. In spite of these losses, however, new blood had entered their lives in the form of various Schneidermans, a collection of stepsisters and step-cousins and a step-aunt, a step-uncle, and a step-grandfather for Ferguson, which for his mother was translated into two stepdaughters, a step-niece and step-nephew, a sister-in-law, a brother-in-law, and a father-in-law. And those Schneidermans now constituted the bulk of the family they belonged to because a city clerk had signed and stamped a marriage certificate declaring Gil and his mother to be lawfully wedded husband and wife. It was a strange change, as Ferguson's grandfather had put it in one of their last talks together. And indeed it was strange to have been given two sisters because of a wedding, two unknown women who had suddenly become his closest relatives because a man who was equally unknown to him had signed his name on a piece of paper. None of that would have mattered if Ferguson had liked Margaret and Ella Schneiderman. But after several encounters with his new step-siblings, he had concluded that those fat, ugly, stuck-up girls didn't deserve to be liked. For it soon became clear that they resented his mother for marrying their father and were disgusted with their father for having betrayed the memory of their mother, who had become a sanctified being after her terrible death in that crack-up on the Taconic State Parkway. Well, Ferguson's father had died a terrible death too, which theoretically should have put all of them in the same boat. But the Schneiderman sisters weren't interested in their new stepbrother. They barely deigned to talk to the 12-year-old nobody. The big college girls from Boston University had no use for the son of the riff-raff woman who had stolen their father from them. And even though Ferguson had been puzzled by their behavior at the wedding, the two of them standing off to the side and talking to no one but each other, mostly in whispers, mostly with their backs turned toward the bride and groom. It wasn't until 2 weeks later, when they were invited to dinner at the New York apartment, that Ferguson understood how nasty and ungenerous they were, particularly Margaret, the older one, although the younger, less obnoxious Ella invariably followed her sister's lead, which was probably even worse. And there the five of them were, at that never-to-be-forgotten dinner, which had taken his mother so many hours to prepare, wanting to prove her solidarity with Gil by putting herself out for his daughters. Those vicious, snotty girls who pretended not to hear his mother when she asked them questions about their life in Boston and what they were planning to do after college, who snidely grilled her about her knowledge of music, which was next to zero, of course, as if to prove to their father that he had married an uncultured imbecile, and when Margaret asked her new stepmother whether she preferred listening to Bach keyboard pieces on the harpsichord, as played by Wanda Landowska, for example, or on the pianoforte by someone like Glenn Gould, not piano, pianoforte, Gil finally exploded and told her to shut up. An open palm slammed down on the dinner table, rattling the silverware and tipping over a glass, and then there was silence, silence not just from Margaret, but from everyone in the room. "Enough with your cutting, insidious remarks," Schneiderman said to his daughter. "I didn't know you were capable of such mean-spiritedness, Margaret, such vicious cruelty. Shame on you, shame on you, shame on you. Rose is a great and magnificent artist, and if you manage to accomplish one-tenth of what she's done in your life, you'll surpass my wildest expectations for you. But one needs a soul to accomplish even the smallest thing in the world, my dear. And from the way you've been acting tonight, I'm beginning to wonder if you have one." It was the first time Ferguson had witnessed his stepfather's anger, which was a bellowing, apoplectic sort of anger, a wrath of such enormity and destructive force that he could only hope it would never be turned in his direction. But how satisfying it was to see it turned on Margaret that night, she who so fully deserved that brutal dressing down from her father, and how glad he was to know that Schneiderman was willing to defend his new wife against the attacks of his own daughter, a great and magnificent artist, which augured well for the future of the marriage, he felt. And when Margaret inevitably collapsed into tears, and a tearful Ella protested that he had no right to talk to her sister like that, Ferguson heard his mother pronounce a phrase, pronounce for the first time a phrase she would go on using whenever Schneiderman lost control of his temper in the months and years ahead. "Easy does it, Gil." Which somehow managed to carry the double weight of both a warning and a caress. And just after he heard his mother say those words for the first time, she stood up from her chair and went over to her husband, a man she had been married to for 16 days. Stood behind him as he went on sitting in his chair at the head of the table, put a hand on each of his shoulders, and then leaned over and kissed him on the back of the neck. Ferguson was impressed by her bravery and composure, which made him think of someone stepping into a cage with a lion, but apparently his mother knew what she was doing. For rather than push her away, Schneiderman reached up and wrapped his right hand around hers, and once he had it firmly in his grasp, he brought her hand down to his mouth and kissed it. They hadn't even looked at each other, but the tantrum had been quelled, or almost quelled, since there was still the matter of an apology to be negotiated, which the stern-voiced Schneiderman eventually pried out of the reluctant, weeping Margaret, who could barely bring herself to look up at her stepmother. But she said the word. She said, "I'm sorry." And because the blow-up had occurred over dessert, strawberries and cream, the meal was essentially done, which allowed the sisters to make a prompt, face-saving exit with the excuse that they had a 9 o'clock date to see some old high school friends, which Ferguson knew to be false, since the girls were supposed to spend the night at the apartment, sleeping in his bedroom while he sacked out on the sofa in the living room, a special fold-out sofa his mother had bought specifically for that purpose. But that never happened, not that night or any other night. For on all future visits to New York, the sisters stayed with their mother's brother and his wife in Riverdale. And if Schneiderman wanted to see them, he had to go to that other apartment or meet with them in public places. But not once did they return to the apartment on Central Park West, and years went by before they set foot in the new apartment overlooking the river. Ferguson didn't care. He wanted nothing to do with either one of those girls, just as he wanted nothing to do with Schneiderman's father, who unfortunately came round to dinner about once a month spouting all kinds of inanities about American politics, the Cold War, New York sanitation workers, quantum physics, and even Ferguson himself. "Watch out for that boy of yours, Liebchen. He has sex on the brain and doesn't even know it yet." But Ferguson did what he could to avoid him, always making sure to wolf down his main course in record time and then claim to be too full for dessert, at which point he would withdraw to his room to study for tomorrow's history test, which in fact had already been given that afternoon. His new not-grandfather was a bit less horrible than Margaret and Ella, perhaps, but not by much, not enough to make Ferguson want to sit around and listen to his crackpot harangues about J. Edgar Hoover's secret concentration camps in Arizona, or the alliance between the John Birch Society and the Communist Party to poison the reservoirs of the New York City water system, which might have been funny in an odd sort of way if the old man hadn't shouted so much. But 20 or 30 minutes in his company was about all Ferguson could stomach. That made 3 new relatives he couldn't abide, 3 Schneidermans he gladly would have done without. But then there were the other Schneidermans, the ones who lived just 13.5 blocks away on West 75th Street. And though he found it difficult to warm up to his step-aunt Liz, who struck him as a crabby, nervous sort of person, too fretful about the minutiae of daily life to understand that life could run out on you before you'd begun to live, he immediately took the Schneiderman's brother, Daniel, and the 2 Schneiderman offspring, step-cousins Jim and Amy, who made Ferguson feel welcome from the start, and thought their Uncle Gil was one lucky son of a bitch, Jim's words, to have married a woman like Ferguson's mother, who, in Amy's words, was just about perfect. Daniel worked as a commercial artist and sometime illustrator of children's books, a self-employed odd jobber who spent 8 to 10 hours a day in a small room at the back of the family apartment that had been converted into a studio, a cluttered, dimly lit micro-atelier where he churned out drawings and paintings for greeting cards, advertisements, calendars, corporate brochures, and Tommy the Bear watercolors for his collaborations with writer Phil Costanza, bringing in enough money to feed, clothe, and house a family of 4, but with nothing left over for extravagances like long summer vacations or private schools for the kids. His work was skilled and professional, bearing the marks of a deft hand and a capricious imagination, and although there was nothing terribly original about what he did, it was never less than charming, a word that was often used to describe Daniel Schneiderman himself, who turned out to be one of the most unpretentious and jovial people Ferguson had ever met, a person who liked to laugh and consequently laughed a lot, an altogether different kind of being from his older brother, the little one who had never had to struggle with a German accent, the handsome one, the unserious one, the one who liked sports, as did step-cousin Jim, long, lean, basketball-playing Jim, who had just started his junior year at the Bronx High School of Science when Gil and Ferguson's mother were married, and once the male contingent of the other Schneidermans learned that their new nephew-cousin was as big on basketball as they were, the duo became a trio, and every time Dan and Jim went to see a game at the Garden, Ferguson was invited to go along with them. That was the old Garden, the now-demolished Madison Square Garden that had once stood on 8th Avenue between 49th and 50th Streets. And so it was that Ferguson was taken to see his first live basketball games during that 1959-60 season. Saturday afternoon college tripleheaders, Harlem Globetrotter exhibitions, and the shoddy, mediocre Knicks of Richie Guerin, Willie Knowles, and Jumping Johnny Green. But there were only 8 teams in the NBA back then, which meant that the Boston Celtics played at the Garden at least 6 times per season, and those were the games the trio made a point of attending, since no one played the game better than that team of Cousy, Hines, and Russell, and the Jones boys. They were a single, 5-part brain in constant motion, a single consciousness, utterly selfless players who thought only of the team and not of themselves. Basketball as it was meant to be played, as Uncle Dan kept repeating as he watched them. And yes, it was astonishing to observe how much better they were than the Knicks, who seemed sluggish and awkward beside them, But much as Ferguson admired the team as a whole, there was one player who stood out for him and captured the bulk of his attention. Sinewy, wire-thin Bill Russell, who always seemed to be at the heart of what the Celtics did, the one whose brain seemed to hold the four other brains inside his head, or a man who had somehow dispersed his brain into the heads of his teammates. For Russell moved strangely and didn't look like an athlete. He was a limited player who rarely took shots or scored, who rarely even dribbled the ball. And yet there he was, snagging another crucial rebound, making another impossible bounce pass, blocking another shot. And because of him, the Celtics kept winning game after game, season after season, champions or competing for the championship every year. And when Ferguson asked Jim what made Russell so great, when in many ways he wasn't even good, Jim paused for a moment to think, shook his head and replied, "I don't know, Archie. Maybe he's just smarter than everyone else. Or maybe it's because he sees more than other people do and always knows what's going to happen next." Beanpole Jim was the answer to Ferguson's age-old prayers, the wish for an older brother, or at least an older cousin friend he could look up to and draw strength from. And Ferguson exulted in their connection, in the way the 16-year-old Jim seemed to have no qualms about embracing his younger step-cousin as a comrade, little understanding that Jim, with a sister and two girl cousins, had no doubt been longing for a brother just as much as he had. In the 2 years before Jim graduated from high school and went off to study at MIT, he turned out to be an essential figure for the often confused and rebellious Ferguson, who was doing well in his classes at the Riverside Academy but continued to have a, quote, attitude problem. Talking back to his teachers, quick to flare up when provoked by thugs like Billy Nathanson. And there was Jim, all curiosity and high spirits, a big-hearted math and science boy who loved to talk about irrational numbers, black holes, artificial intelligence, and Pythagorean dilemmas, with no anger in him, never a rude word or a pugnacious gesture toward anyone. And surely his example helped tamp down the excessiveness of Ferguson's behavior somewhat. And there, too, was Jim giving Ferguson the lowdown on female anatomy and what to do about the ever more persistent problem of sex on the brain, cold showers, ice cubes on your dick, 3-mile runs around the track. And best of all, there was Jim on the basketball court with him, the 5-foot-11-inch high school junior, the 6-foot-1-inch senior, who would meet Ferguson on Saturday mornings at the midway point between their two apartments and walk down to Riverside Park with him, where they would find an empty court and practice together for 3 hours, 7 sharp every Saturday, as long as the weather gods were with them, drizzles being acceptable but not downpours, flurries but not sleet or heavy snow, and nothing doing if the temperature dropped below 25 degrees, frozen fingers, or rose above 95, heat prostration, which meant they were out there on most Saturdays until Jim packed his bags and left for college. No more trotting along beside his mother on weekend photo outings for young Mr. Ferguson. Those days were finished forever, and from now on it was basketball, which he had discovered at 12, when the ball stopped being too large and heavy for him to control, and by the time he was 12 and a half, it had become the new passion of his life, the next best thing to movies and kissing girls. And how fortunate it was that Jim had arrived on the scene just then and was willing to give up 3 hours every week instructing him on how to play. What a miraculous turn that was, the right person at the right time. How often did that happen? And because Jim was a good and conscientious player, more than good enough to have made his high school team if he had chosen to go out for it, he was a good teacher of fundamentals, and one by one he led Ferguson through the basic drills of how to execute a proper layup, how to move his feet on defense, how to box out for rebounds, how to throw a bounce pass, how to shoot free throws, how to bank the ball off the backboard, how to release the ball at maximum altitude when taking a jump shot. So many things to learn: dribbling with his left hand, setting picks, keeping his arms up on defense, and then the games of OUT and horse at the end of each session. which turned into games of one-on-one in the second year. As Ferguson sprouted up to 5'4", 5'6", and 5'7", always losing to the taller, more experienced Jim, but beginning to hold his own after his 14th birthday, at times respectable enough to pour in 5 or 6 straight jumpers through the netless rims of Riverside Park, the same denuded rims to be found in every public park across the city. And because they played by the New York rule of winners out, whenever Ferguson went on one of his shooting sprees, he would come dangerously close to not losing. As Jim put it after one of the last games they played together, "Give it another year, Archie. Grow another 2 or 3 inches, and you'll be wiping my ass off the court." He spoke those words with the proud satisfaction of a teacher who had taught his pupil well. And then it was Boston and goodbye, and a new hole was dug in Ferguson's heart. Within a year and a half of his mother's marriage to Gil, Ferguson had gathered enough information about the Schneidermans to have reached some definitive conclusions about his new family. In the left-hand column of his mental ledger, placed the names of 3 duds and 1 semi-dud, the unmentionable uglies, 2, the demented patriarch, 1, and the well-meaning but inconstant and overwrought Aunt Liz, half. In the right-hand column were the names of the 4 others, admirable Gil, amiable Dan, ardent Jim, and increasingly attractive Amy. In sum, he counted 3.5 negatives as opposed to 4 positives, which mathematically proved that there was more to be thankful for than to grumble about. And with the Adlers all but gone from the land of the living, and the Fergusons entirely absent now, Uncle Lou in prison, Aunt Millie somewhere in Florida, Uncle Arnold and Aunt Joan in Los Angeles, Cousin Francie in Santa Barbara, married, the mother of 2 kids, and his other cousins scattered across the country and no longer in touch, the 4 good Schneidermans were essentially all Ferguson had left. And because one of those Schneidermans was married to his mother, and the other 3 lived just minutes away on the same Riverside Drive where he lived, Ferguson grew ever more attached to them. For the positives in his family ledger were far more positive than the negatives were negative. And even though his life had been diminished in some ways, it had been greatly enhanced in others. Amy was the Schneiderman bonus, the birthday present hidden under a pile of bunched-up wrapping paper that doesn't get found until after the party is over and all the guests have gone home. It was Ferguson's fault for not paying more attention to her, but there had been so many things to adjust to in the beginning, and he hadn't known what to make of the gawky, grinning creature who waggled and flung out her arms when she talked and couldn't seem to sit still. Such an odd-looking girl with those braces on her teeth and that head of tangled, dirty blonde hair. But then the braces came off, her hair was cut into a short bob, and by the time Ferguson turned 13, he noticed that breasts were beginning to grow inside Amy's formerly useless training bra, and that his already 13-year-old step-cousin no longer resembled the girl she had been at 12. A week after the move from Central Park West to Riverside Drive, she called him up after school one day and boldly announced that she was coming over for a visit. When he asked her why she wanted to see him, she said, "Because we've known each other for 6 months, and in all that time you haven't said more than 3 words to me. We're supposed to be cousins now, Archie, and I want to find out if it's worth the trouble to be friends with you or not." His mother and stepfather were both out that afternoon, and with no snack material in the cupboard beyond a half-eaten box of stale Fig Newtons, Ferguson felt at a loss, uncertain how he should handle this abrupt intrusion. After Amy hung up the phone in her apartment, it took just 18 minutes before she was pushing the downstairs buzzer of his apartment. But in that interval, Ferguson toyed with and discarded at least 6 ideas about what he could do to entertain her. Watch television? Look at family photo albums? Show her the complete 37-volume set of Shakespeare plays and poems Gil had given to him for his birthday, then decided to haul out the movie projector and portable screen from the utility closet and set them up for a viewing of one of his Laurel and Hardy films, which was probably a terrible mistake, he realized, since girls didn't like Laurel and Hardy, at least none of the girls he had ever known, starting with the beautiful Isabel Kraft 2 or 3 years earlier, who had made a face when he asked her what she thought of them, a sentiment that had been echoed just recently by his current number one, Rachel Mineta, who had called them juvenile and idiotic, and then in walked Amy on that cool afternoon in March 1960, dressed in a white sweater, a gray pleated skirt, saddle shoes, and white cotton socks, the ubiquitous bobby socks of the moment. And when Ferguson announced his intention to show her blotto, a Laurel and Hardy two-reeler from 1930, she smiled and said, "Great, I love Laurel and Hardy. After the Marx Brothers, they're the best team ever. Forget the Three Stooges. Forget Abbott and Costello. Stan and Ollie are the cheese." No, Amy wasn't like any of the other girls he knew. And as Ferguson watched her laughing at the film, heard her laughing at the film for a good 14 of the 26 minutes it lasted, he concluded that it would indeed be worth the trouble to try to become friends with her. For her laugh wasn't the squealing, out-of-control noise of a child, he noted, but a succession of gut-deep, resonant guffaws, merry yaps to be sure, but at the same time thoughtful, as if she understood why she was laughing, which made her laugh an intelligent laugh, a laugh that laughed at itself, even as it laughed at what it was laughing at. Too bad that she went to public school and not the Riverside Academy, which eliminated the possibility of daily contact, but in spite of their involvement with their separate friends, and in spite of their various after-school activities, piano and dance lessons for Amy, sports for Ferguson, they managed to get together once every 10 days or so following Amy's impromptu visit in March, which worked out to 3 or 4 times a month, not counting the additional times when they saw each other for joint family outings, holiday dinners, trips to Carnegie Hall with Gil, and special events, Jim's high school graduation party, the old buzzard's 80th birthday bash. But for the most part, they saw each other alone, walking through Riverside Park when the weather was good, sitting in one of their two apartments when it was bad, occasionally going to the movies together, or working on school assignments at the same table together, or hanging out together in one of their apartments on Friday night to watch the new television program they were both so keen on, The Twilight Zone. But mostly when they were together, they talked. Or Amy talked and Ferguson listened, for no one he knew had more to say about the world than Amy Schneiderman, who seemed to have an opinion on every subject and knew so much more than he did about nearly everything. Brilliant, obstreperous Amy, who teased her father and joked with her brother and warded off her mother's perpetual fussing with acerbic, know-it-all put-downs that she somehow managed to get away with without being scolded or punished, most likely because she was a girl who spoke her mind and had trained the people in her family to respect her for that. And not even Ferguson, who had rapidly become her new ace copain, was altogether immune from her insults and criticisms. No matter how vociferously she claimed to like him and admire him, she often found him lazy in the head and was continually appalled by his lack of interest in politics, by how little thought he was giving to Kennedy's presidential campaign and the civil rights movement. But Ferguson couldn't be bothered, he said. He hoped Kennedy would win, but even if he did become president, things wouldn't get any better than they were now. They just wouldn't get a whole lot worse. And as for the civil rights movement, of course he was in favor of it. How could anyone be against justice and equality for all? But he was only 13 years old, for heaven's sake. No more than an insignificant speck of dust. And what the hell could a speck do about changing the world? No excuses, Amy said. You're not going to be 13 forever, and then what happens to you? You can't spend your life thinking only about yourself, Archie. You have to let something in, or else you'll turn into one of those hollowed-out people you hate so much. You know, one of the walking dead from Zombieville, USA. We shall overcome, Ferguson said. No, my funny little speck man, you shall overcome. It was odd being so close to a girl, Ferguson discovered, especially a girl he had no desire to kiss, which was an unprecedented form of friendship in his experience, as intense as any friendship he had ever had with a boy, and yet, in that Amy was a girl, There was a different tonality to their interactions. A boy-girl buzz just below the surface that was nevertheless unlike the buzz he felt with Rachel Mineta or Alice Abrams or any of the other girls he had crushes on and kissed when he was 13. A loud buzz as opposed to the soft buzz he felt with Amy, since she was supposed to be his cousin, a member of his own family, which meant he had no right to kiss her or even think about kissing her. And so great was the interdiction that it never once crossed Ferguson's mind to go against it, knowing that such an act would have been highly improper, if not deeply shocking. And even though Amy was becoming more and more attractive to him, as he watched her body unfurl into the high bloom of her early adolescent womanhood, not pretty in the way Isabel Kraft was pretty, perhaps, but arresting, alive in her eyes as no girl had ever been for him, Ferguson continued to resist the urge to break the code of family honor. Then they turned 14, first Amy in December, followed by Ferguson in March, and suddenly he found himself inhabiting a new body that was no longer under his control, a body that produced unbidden erections and much shortness of breath, the early masturbation phase in which no thought that wasn't an erotic thought could fit inside his skull, the delirium of becoming a man without the privileges of being a man, turmoil, consternation, relentless chaos within, and whenever he looked at Amy now, his first and only thought was how much he wanted to kiss her, which he sensed was beginning to be true for her whenever she looked at him. One Friday evening in April, with Gil and his mother off at some dinner party downtown, he and Amy sat alone in the seventh-floor apartment discussing the term kissing cousins, which Ferguson admitted he didn't fully understand, since it seemed to conjure up an image of cousins politely kissing each other on the cheek, which didn't seem right somehow, since that kind of kissing didn't qualify as genuine kissing. And therefore, why kissing cousins when the people in his head were just normal cousins? At which point Amy laughed and said, "No, silly, this is what kissing cousins means." And without saying another word, she leaned toward Ferguson on the sofa, put her arms around him, and planted a kiss on his mouth, which soon became a kiss that was traveling into his mouth. And from that moment on, Ferguson decided that they weren't really cousins after all.